At one level, the current global economic crisis is, or better put, depression, is pretty easy to understand. Global average profit rates across the planet resulted in an increase in speculative investment, a huge speculative bubble, and that bubble has gone down. The growth of financial speculation over recent decades has been absolutely spectacular. You've probably all heard about the subprime crisis in the United States. My favourite subprime loan category is the ninja loan. That is a loan to somebody who has no income and no job. That's a speculative loan. I don't want to talk particularly about the housing industry. Foreign exchange transactions in 2004 were more than 60 times greater than the value of all of the world's exports. In other words, most of the foreign exchange transactions turning one currency into another were about speculation, not about facilitating trade. In 2005, the notional amount of over-the-counter foreign exchange derivatives, which are highly complicated means of speculating in foreign exchange transactions, the total amount of these derivatives was almost 2.5 times greater than the value of global exports. Private equity, leveraged buyouts were another area in which large amounts of speculation went on. Hedge funds, which were all about speculation, managed over $1.1 trillion in assets in 2006. While the US financial sector only realised 10% of US corporate profits in 1980, the figure was 40% in 2007. Now, it may come as a little surprise to you, but the finance sector actually doesn't create any new wealth or value. So what's going on is that profits are being realised in a speculative area of the economy that doesn't create any new wealth, and the profits that are actually created in the productive sector, that sector is making much less profits. Eventually, and with similar consequences for people's lives, this huge speculative bubble burst. And to mix a metaphor, it came down like a jerry-built school in China's Sichuan province last year, with similar kinds of consequences. Lots of kids got killed when that earthquake hit Sichuan last year. Many people are going to die because of the economic crisis that we're living through at present. The global financial system is in tatters, and as lending, borrowing, and thus much consumption, and especially real investment, has, as a consequence, kangaroo hopped to a halt like an amateur driving a geared car for the first time. More profoundly, once the illusions of profitability that had been sustained by the speculation had subsided, the fundamental reason to invest in the real economy disappeared. The reason to invest under capitalism is to make profits. Now, this doesn't answer the crucial question which everybody, I think, is thinking about. What can be done to make things better? To end what is known as the GFC, the global financial crisis, what the IMF has called the Great Recession, and what really seems to be a new Great Depression, or in more analytical Marxist terms, a breakdown of capitalism. When I was asked to do this talk, I said, I'll prepare it a couple of days beforehand because things are moving quickly. I didn't have the guts to do that, but it was actually a realistic insight. The IMF forecast world growth this year to be 3.9% back in July in 2008. On the 19th of March 2009, the IMF thought that growth would be -0.5% to -1%. Minus growth means that the world economy contracts. Less than a fortnight later, The World Bank on the 31st of March forecast world growth this year to be minus 1.7%, and on its calculation, this is the first global contraction for the whole global economy in the entire post-war period. Just a few days ago, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a think tank for the rich nations, really, it forecast world global economic contraction of 2.7%. And yesterday, we heard the latest unemployment figures for Australia. Unemployment had gone up by a whole 0.5% in the space of 1 month. Unemployment is now, on the extremely restrictive definitions of unemployment in Australia, it's now 5.7%. If you work 1 hour a week, don't make it onto the unemployment statistics at all. Well, how do we explain what's going on? Before looking at the measures that ruling classes are taking to deal with the crisis, which is really what the guts of this talk is about, before looking at what these measures means in class terms and how successful they're likely to be, let's go quickly through the explanations of the crisis that are on offer and the solutions that they recommend. There is, however, a terrible temptation to take far too seriously mainstream economic theories. It's not that Rudd or Gordon Brown or Barack Obama were closet Keynesians when they came to office, or that they were convinced and about a particular approach for the economy, or that amongst their top advisers and their entourages there were thought-out Keynesians. No, there has been a shift towards Keynesian economics in order to justify what these guys wanted to do. It's not theory first, then action. It's action and then how the fuck do we justify this? I remember I went to university in the 1960s. I went to university in the 70s, but I'm talking as one of Barack's advisors. I went to university in the 1960s. They talked about this old guy called Keynes who said it was okay to increase government investment if things went into the economy. Let's look at him again. Okay, back to the actual explanations of the crisis. There is significant debate inside ruling classes across the planet about what to do. There isn't a real consensus amongst ruling classes about the course of action that should be taken. And that is a dramatic contrast with the distant past last year, when there was a neoliberal consensus about how individual economies and how the global economy should be run. There has been a flight from many of the aspects of neoliberalism, but there are still some diehards, like John Taylor of Stanford University and the hacks at the Institute of Public Affairs in Australia or John Stone. They blame government for the current global crisis. Governments interfered with financial and other markets, and you know, we just know in our hearts or in our bowels or in some other organ, we know that markets work well. And so government interference must be the problem. So the solution is pretty straightforward. Cut back on government spending and cut back on regulation. Let the market rip. And these people are pretty hard-headed. They also say bankruptcies will clear out the mess. They're prepared to see big, large-scale bankruptcies, and everything will be hunky-dory in not too long. Neoliberals of that kind these days are relatively few in number, but there are other conservative approaches. Another ideology that has been essentially resurrected is monetarism, which was basically a conservative economic ideology, and Ben Bernanke, who's the chairperson of the Reserve Bank of the United States, counts amongst monetarists. They agree that governments are at fault, and in particular, the previous head of the Federal Reserve in the United States, Alan Greenspan, he's particularly to blame because earlier on, to deal with some problems in the US economy, he held interest rates in the United States down too far and for too long. What's the solution? Well, there should be less government interference with markets in the future, but in the short term, banks should be bailed out. They certainly shouldn't be nationalised, but they should be bailed out, and the money supply should be expanded. In other words, reserve banks in different countries should print more money or create electronically create more money. This will restore the financial system and confidence in the financial system, because all of the problems are in the financial system. And once that's happened, everything will be hunky-dory. Keynesians like Paul Krugman, Joseph Stiglitz in Australia, John Quiggin and Ross Gittins all agree that the government's at fault. But the government's at fault for deregulating markets, as occurred, well, really in Australia from the 1980s through the 1990s through the 2000s. And this deregulation of banking and the financial system led to disaster because, from a Keynesian perspective, the financial system is faulty. It has to be guided by government. In fact, the economy as a whole has to be guided by government. And the solution is to re-regulate the financial system. Don't allow clever investment bankers to invent all sorts of remarkable new instruments for shuffling money and speculating, which, you know, a few handfuls of people in the world really understand how they operate. Don't allow that to happen. Put greater controls on bank lending. Give greater powers to central banks. Do that on the one hand to try and fix problems in the financial system, and on the other hand, increase demand in the economy by boosting government spending. In the short term, they think that banks should be taken over by governments to deal with their bad debts, or what are called now toxic debts. This will restore confidence in the financial system, demand will be maintained by government, and everything will be hunky-dory. Then there are pragmatists, like our Kevin, like the French Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of Britain, and Barack Obama. They've got a pretty good idea that things have gone wrong. And their solution is to do a bit of everything, so long for the time being as it doesn't antagonise significant sections of the capitalist class too much. And if you do a bit of everything and you don't piss off too many capitalists, then everything should be pretty much hunky-dory. Now, to sum up the Marxist explanation, which I gave you in a very, very brief form at the beginning, and which you can hear more about tomorrow when there's going to be a talk about the Marxist theory of economic crisis, which will be more theoretical. The Marxist approach, to put it very, very briefly, I think you'll be able to grasp this, capitalism is to blame. And the solution is to fight to maintain working class living standards in the short term, and out of today's struggles, build a movement to smash the bosses and smash the state. This will establish the basis for workers' power and everything will be hunky-dory. Now let's look at what governments are actually doing. Some of the measures that governments are taking are pretty much common sense. That doesn't mean that they're working, but they're pretty much common sense. The first thing that governments have done is to lower interest rates. Now, I've got my slides out of order. So this is the slide I want here. The first thing to do is to lower interest rates, and this has been done big time with really rapid cuts in central bank interest rates over the past, in the case of the US, going on for 2 years, in the case of Australia, less than 1 year. The Reserve Bank of Australia cut its important cash rate from 7.25% to 3.25% between March and December 2008, a fall of 4% in that short period of time. This is unprecedented. There was a further 0.25% cut just a few days ago. Has this worked? Well, it doesn't seem to have worked terribly well. And what's more, there are precedents for dramatically cutting interest rates in order to kickstart the economy again. In Japan, there was a deep recession that began around 1989. And the Japanese central bank pulled down interest rates to approximately zero for years on end. And it didn't work. John Maynard Keynes wrote about a liquidity trap. When people do not want to borrow in order to consume or to invest, no matter how low the interest rate is. And it's quite clear that the global financial crisis has led to this situation. Low interest rates, well, certainly low central bank interest rates, are not having an effect of kickstarting economies. It's worth noting, as has happened in Australia, that the fact that central banks have reduced their interest rates don't necessarily mean that actual retail banks that you might have some money, well, at least your pay might go into it, might come out immediately again, but you have some relationship with a retail bank, that their interest rates haven't fallen as much as the interest rates that are offered by central banks. Part of the problem is these toxic assets that banks, especially in the United States, but also in Europe and Japan, own. Notably, these subprime loans, but other kinds of assets as well. Banks are worried about lending, especially to other banks, because they don't know how much bad debt these other banks might have, and therefore the risk that is involved in lending to them. So interest rates, that's an obvious kind of a solution. Doesn't seem to have worked terribly effectively. Well, the next set of measures are bailing out, regulating and taking over banks. In September 2008, the US government bailed out one of the largest investment banks, Citibank, to the tune of $50 billion US dollars plus guarantees for its toxic assets to the tune of more than $300 billion US dollars. Just on the question of scale, is everybody au fait with what a trillion is? A trillion is a one that has a lot of friends, 12 zeros after it. That's what a trillion is. And in terms of scale, the Australian economy is worth about $1 trillion US dollars. The global economy last year was worth about $60 trillion US dollars. The European Union's GDP was about $19 trillion. The USA's $14 trillion. Japan 5. Germany 4. China 4. And Australia $4 trillion. While the US, Basically, the US government has bailed out various kinds of financial institutions to the tune of well over $1 trillion. And one index, Not only has there been this bailing out going on to the tune of not just $1 trillion, but actually multiple trillions if we take into account all of the developed economies. But there is also a number of other measures that have been taken to try and prop up the financial system. In October 2008, the Irish government guaranteed bank deposits in Ireland to try and stop a run on banks in Ireland, which immediately meant that countries across the world had to do the same thing if all of the money wasn't to flow into Ireland. And the Australian government did that, Rudd did that as well. That's another means of propping up the financial system. At the recent G20 meeting, there was a lot of fuss made about regulating the global financial system and the banking business. What they came up with was basically a expanded talk shop to talk about increased regulation. There was no specific agreement about what the regulations would be, but this committee in Basel, a forum in Basel, would have its name changed and its status increased, and that there would be talk about greater national regulation of banking activity. A bit before that, the International Monetary Fund stated that turning around the global growth will depend critically on more concerted policy actions to stabilise financial conditions, as well as sustained strong policy support to bolster demand. So that's a bit of the monetary stuff, bolster the financial system and also inject more money through government spending, stimulus packages. Paul Krugman, who's a Keynesian, has written, "I don't think it's just a financial panic. I believe that it represents the failure of the whole model of banking, of an overgrown financial sector that did more harm than good." So both amongst Keynesians and monetarists, there's a recognition that the financial system is important, and these measures of bailing out, regulating, and in some cases taking over banks, as has happened in Iceland, where basically all of the main banks totally collapsed and have now been nationalised. It's happened in the UK with Northern Rock and Lloyds Bank taken over. In practice, some of the US banks are more or less government-owned in the United States, although not all of the ones that are in a bad way. All of these measures have been designed to keep the financial system from totally breaking down, which would virtually end all borrowing and lending and lead to even further falls in consumption and an end to any investment at all. How bailouts are funded is important, and I'm going to go get back to that later on. How effective are these measures to do with the financial system? Well, if the problem in the global economy at the moment is that there were some silly bankers who did some silly things, then this approach may well work if the problem is purely a financial one. Once confidence is restored by quarantining bad assets and introducing better regulation, then the financial system can work again. But for the economy to grow rapidly enough to reduce employment, given population growth and increased productivity, there has to be more investment, and a key determinant of investment is the rate of profit. If that remains low, a renovated financial system will not be enough. If it's not just the financial system that is the problem, but rather something deeper, something in the real economy, the part of the economy that's actually involved in producing real wealth, then sorting out the financial system is certainly not going to be enough by itself. And Keynesians recognise this. This is where Keynesian arguments are invoked. In Australia, government spending has come in a couple of stimulus packages. In the US, it's called discretionary spending. The US has already made, the Obama government has already made commitments to spend the equivalent of 2% of gross domestic product in discretionary spending. Australia has committed about 2.1%. In China, 3.2% of gross domestic product is going to be, the equivalent of that is going to be spent by government to try and keep demand up, to keep production going. In South Korea, 2.3%, Japan and the UK, 1.4%. Germany, 1.5%. Meanwhile, government debt in G20 countries is forecast to rise from about 65% of gross domestic product last year to about 75% of gross domestic product. The idea is that if governments spend more, then demand goes up. People have more money, they spend the money that they have, and production increases. And if production increases, then it makes sense for there to be more private sector investment. This is one of the key arguments in Keynes's most important text, the Theory of Employment, Interest and Money. There are a number of kinds of government expenditure that have been involved here and elsewhere. There are general payments to individuals, transfer payments, giving money to people. Some of you may be getting around $900, or maybe you've already got it, from a government handout, and you can do with it what you like. You can pay off some debt. You can get some food. You can. Well, you could give it to Socialist Alternative, or you could buy new expensive jewellery. I mean, you could do with it whatever you like. The problem is that given the levels of personal indebtedness, a significant proportion of this money is going to go in paying off debt rather than creating new demand. And it's new demand that the government wants to initiate. So there are also specific kinds of transfer payments that governments are making where you can't spend the money on whatever you like. You've got to spend it on something in particular within a short period of time. And what the Australian government has particularly targeted is housing. So the government is subsidising the purchase of houses to the tune of about $7,000 if you're a new home buying a house, and to the tune of $14,000 if you are buying a newly built house. And the knock-on effects of that will be greater than the knock-on effects of just giving poor people like you extra money, because the money that's going on housing will definitely be spent on housing. And in particular, the money that's spent on new houses will actually employ people to build the new houses. The problem is that most of the money is actually going on spending old houses. And so in the newspapers, we've heard the cheerful news that the recovery is on the way because house prices are, you know, a bit stronger in Australia, which is entirely due to the fact that there is a speculative increase in the price of housing. It's not that any new wealth is being created, it's rather that the price of houses and apartments is being bidded up because the government is subsidising this expenditure. Another approach which the government in Australia and elsewhere is doing big time is spending on infrastructure. This is supposed to work in a similar way to the payments to individuals. The government will pay for new railways, new roads, new ports, and so on. This will employ large numbers of people. It'll employ people to build new libraries and schools, new labs at schools and so on, but not, as a teacher in the ACT pointed out to me, not air conditioners for existing classrooms so that in summer students can actually think. That's not part of it. It has to just be big things. This also has the advantage from the point of view of the capitalist class that there are big profits to be made by contractors who organise the work. And the idea is that at the end, there'll be more demand, more people will be employed. Those people who are employed will then spend the money that they get in wages and they'll buy more stuff, and there'll be knock-on effects through the economy, what Keynesians call the multiplier. And at the end of this process also, there'll be these new big infrastructure assets. Well, this might work if the problem is short-term. If government spending improves business and consumer confidence, then more will be lent, borrowed and spent, and overall output will increase. But if this depression results from lower profit rates, infrastructure spending won't help much, and nor will the transfer payments. The depression will last a long time, and deficit spending will itself create problems, because you have to ask, where is the money coming from? Where is the money that the government's spending coming from? Well, it can come from taxes, but I haven't heard Kevin recently say, shit, things are bad, we've got to tax the rich. There are proposals to increase taxes, and in any case, increasing taxes undermines the solution within the framework of capitalism in the medium to long term, because it's a deduction on the profitability of the private sector, and everything depends on the profitability of the private sector. They have to be making profits in order to want to invest. Governments can also borrow. A long time ago in 2007-2008, the Australian government had a surplus of about $21 billion. That is, it was getting $21 billion more in its income than it was paying out. What was forecast in February this year was that there would be a deficit of $22 billion in Australia, and that was in February. I mean, let's face it, it's going to be significantly bigger. What's more, the money that's been borrowed has to be paid back eventually, and it has to be paid back with interest. So in the future, the government has to raise more money either through more debts or through taxation, which can create problems for the rate of surplus value for profits in the future. Another way of funding government spending has also been pursued as a direct solution to the problem of the current crisis, and that is by creating new money, what's called technically quantitative easing, which is creating new money, not just printing it, but also just putting money into government accounts effectively electronically. Milton Friedman, who is the wicked fairy of monetarism, he talked about a solution being helicopter money. If the economy is in a really bad way, what you need to do is increase the money supply, and the fairest way of doing that is giving some money to everybody by throwing it out of helicopters so that everybody gets some. They haven't adopted a helicopter approach. They haven't adopted any kind of approach which would give the money to everybody. In practice, what governments that have engaged in this kind of policy have been doing, and that's the UK government and the US government in particular and the Japanese government, not yet the Australian government, is to give money to the most deserving. The banks. Now, this approach of increasing the money supply is fine if it results in increasing demand and output. But if most of the new money is saved or is frittered away on crazy investments, then for the same reason that there was a liquidity trap in the first place, the increase in the money supply won't work either. It won't have much of an impact. To summarise where we're at now, I'm going to draw on the right-wing historian, Neil Ferguson. He's very right-wing. He thinks imperialism is a very good thing, and he's prepared to use the word as well. He summed up the effectiveness of both Keynesian and monetarist policies. We are doing both of these things right now, sort of real-time lessons from history, and the results are a little disappointing, it must be said. Well, he's certainly right there. So if the current crisis is due to deeper causes in the rate of profit, and these policies aren't likely to result in a return to pre-crisis growth rates, are there other things that can be and are being done? Well, actually, there are, and they derive from the first set of explanations, from neoliberalism. Some of the policies that were pursued during the boom years. Some neoliberalism is still here. Kevin Rudd is giving with one hand and taking with the other. Obama has promised that the US budget will be back in balance within 5 or 6 years. To quote from the Bible, a Keynesian giveth and taketh away. With the one hand, there's stimulus packages. With the other hand, Rudd and the Labor government are taking a scythe to the public service. They're cutting back on public expenditure. So that's one policy. Another neoliberal policy is bankruptcy. Some firms are allowed to go to the wall. Now, at this stage, not many big firms have been allowed to go to the wall because of the knock-on effects. If one big company goes, then that can topple a whole lot over. But Bear Stearns was allowed to fall over. The neoliberals say there should be more of that. And there's also rationalisation, which is a kind of controlled bankruptcy. So Obama has made it clear that he wants the car industry in the United States restructured. What does that mean? That means mass sackings, the closure of large numbers of plants in the US to keep the most productive, the most profitable of the plants open. It's controlled bankruptcies, controlled closure of whole sections of industry. Then there's attacking the working class by raising the rate of exploitation. Governments talking about how we're all in the same boat and, to mix a metaphor, how we should all pull in our belts together. Remember Rudd's recent message to the Fair Pay Commission, essentially that an excessive minimum wage increase would reduce employment. In other words, the Fair Pay Commission should hold down real wages. Individual bosses are using their increased bargaining power, because unemployment is going up, to push down conditions and pay. And this is particularly true in the black economy, where wages for hospitality workers, for example, have already gone down dramatically. And we've seen wage freezes and cuts in conditions at Alcoa, with the blessing of the ACTU, at AMP, Qantas, Virgin Blue, Santos and Holden in Australia. All support these cuts in pay and conditions are supposed to be saving jobs. They may save jobs for a period of months, but there will be mass layoffs in the very near future. As the Financial Review put it last Saturday, with so much talent around, employers are in a position to replace underperforming workers. The boss is back, and you have to work harder just to stay where you are. Like it or lump it, for many, that's how the workplace is shaping up. Then there's another approach to dealing with the crisis, imperialism, which involves shifting the burden of the Depression onto other countries, especially by excluding them from markets, from sources of cheap raw materials, or imposing unfavourable exchange rates on them. Can this set of measures work? Well, actually, maybe. They can work. If the planet isn't destroyed by nuclear war and global warming, and at the expense of the lives and well-being of billions of people. It might work. So perhaps we should work on a somewhat different approach. It should be here. But the approach that's here is not quite it. We shouldn't be solving the problems of capitalism, but solving the problem that is capitalism by getting rid of it. We can't wait around till the financiers jump. We've got to build organisations, and in particular a revolutionary party and a mass movement that can push the fuckers out the window.